We're back in the book of Ruth, and I believe that Ruth chapter 3 has timeless truths for us that are intended to help us and instruct us and teach us. I have to admit this is one of the most difficult chapters I've ever preached, and maybe that's a surprise to you, but I'm just calling it as I see it, because preaching is to take this ancient text, which in this case is indeed ancient, and to bring it to bear, its meaning, its significance, to a modern person. That's you, a modern person. And so Ruth 3 has in it a number of obstacles in that transfer. It is so otherworldly. It really is. And as I read it to you, I know that it's a familiar story to kids who grew up in the church. You know the story of Ruth. You know what happens in chapter 3. There's nothing mysterious going on here as far as the drama that's in it. But I want you to take in all the otherworldliness, the ancientness of this passage, and recognize that God put it here not to confuse us, but to instruct us and to teach us. And I've just found this chapter to have some really valuable lessons, especially for us in Crossroads. Some valuable lessons about redemption is the big picture lesson, and some valuable lessons about nobility and honor. And that's really what I see glowing out of this text. So let me read it to you, and then we'll make some comments on Ruth chapter 3, Ruth 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? And now is not Boaz our kinsman, with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do." And she said to her, "All that you say, I will do." And so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." And then he said, "May you be blessed of Yahweh, my daughter. You've shown your last kindness to be better than the first, by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you're a woman of excellence. And now it is true I'm a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you. As Yahweh lives, lie down until morning." So she lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another and said, "Let it not be known that the woman has come to the threshing floor." Again he said, "Give me the cloak that is on you and hold it." So she held it, and he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and when she went into the city, and then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did it go, my daughter?" And she told her all that the man had done for her. And she said, "These 6 measures of barley he gave me, for he said, 'Do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" And then she said, "Wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today." So reads the word of the living God. Abraham Lincoln was at a crossroads in his life. He didn't know what he would do or become. And he tried his hand at many things before he was even close to the presidency. He and his friend William Berry opened a general store after he moved to New Salem, Illinois. It was one of 3 general stores in the town, and they didn't do very well. Eventually, that store would close, unable to hold up with the competition and unable to completely hold Lincoln's interest. He was a precocious man, even when he was young, thoughtful and absorbed into various things. And when Abraham Lincoln was minding that general store, he tells the story of a couple that were moving out west, and that couple stopped by his store to see if they could gain any extra money for their journey with the small amount of stuff that they had. He wasn't interested in really anything that they were selling, except he saw the look of desperation in the woman's eyes, and so he offered to buy an old barrel on the wagon. They were glad to sell it to him, and he paid them 50 cents. He says he thinks it was all the money he had that day. 50 cents was a fair price for this old barrel with some papers and refuse in it, and he bought the barrel, moved it into his store, and didn't think of it for quite some time. Until weeks later, Lincoln dug through that barrel, a bunch of papers in the bottom. But he found in there a book on a topic that he had become increasingly interested in lately. It's a book called Blackstone's Commentary on English Law, an expensive book at that time, and a book that anyone interested in constitutional law, in the study of the law, would have wanted to acquire. And this is before Lincoln started to borrow a lot of law books from friends who were in that field. This was one of the first and earliest books that made an impact on Lincoln's thinking about the Constitution and about governance and law. And because the store wasn't very successful, especially in the summer, when the farmers, who were the ones who were the customers of the store, were out working from early in the morning to late at night, Lincoln would sit on the porch and he would read Blackstone's Commentary on English Law. He would later comment how that book impressed him and how it shaped his thinking when it came to matters of law. Little did Lincoln know at that time how significant that pursuit would become. He would eventually pass what was the equivalent in those days of a bar exam. It was a group of lawyers that would let you be a lawyer too, which is pretty much what they do today. And he would become, you know, first a lawyer and then a legislature and eventually the president, 16th president of the United States. All because of a desperate couple's barrel of trash. Kind of. Right? Kind of. I mean, if that book had that big of an impact, and he got his hands on that book because a couple, because of circumstances we know nothing about, was moving out west. Lots of couples were doing that day, many of them out of desperation, many families westward ho. But because of all that, we could trace that, I suppose, to the wisdom of Lincoln in the emancipation of the slaves, guiding our country through the Civil War, and becoming at least one of the most respected and famous presidents in our nation's history, all because of a barrel of trash. Kind of. I like stories like that because they're reminders of the smallest details in our lives and the circumstances that surround them and how those details become so significant. A barrel is not as significant as a presidency, but somehow you can see a correlation between those two things, and that's the doctrine we discussed in Ruth chapter 2, the doctrine of God's providence. It is his care, his unseen guidance, his handiwork in his creation, in fact, his ongoing work in his creation to uphold and administer and to control and to direct all things according to his purposes. And it's one of the greatest messages of the book of Ruth. Why would this Moabitess, a foreign woman, defer on the opportunity to return to her own people, but instead make a covenant with a follower of Yahweh, an angry follower of Yahweh, a bitter follower of Yahweh, and link her life and destiny to this other woman? What would compel her to do that? We don't fully know, except that Yahweh had got a hold of her heart and she was committed and resolute to do just that. And what would make this widow accept this offer in her bitterness to take on another liability when herself was in such a difficult position? We don't know, except that was the choice that she made. And as they returned to Bethlehem, what provided the welcome that they received? Various circumstances, including the end of a drought and the end of a famine and the return of harvest to the land. And what would cause Ruth to take that initiative to go and find work to provide for her mother-in-law, who she had committed this loyalty and faithfulness to care for her? And what would lead her and guide her to a particular field, a field that just so happened to be owned by a near-off relative of Naomi, Boaz? And what would be the cause of her receiving, especially in the days of Judges, the context of the book of Ruth, favorable treatment when she arrived at that place, and not harassment or worse from the field workers? What caused all these circumstances to come about the way that they came about? And for, on that very day, the owner of the field to arrive and to see her among all of these workers, to see her and recognize her as a foreigner and to inquire about her. And what would open his heart to extend such lavish generosity, not just in allowing her to glean in the corners of his field as the Mosaic law provided for the poor and the sojourner, but to accidentally drop big sheaves of barley and allow for her to take on all of this extra. And not only for that day, but for weeks to come, because when we get to chapter 3, verse 1, we see that the harvest, the barley harvest, had come to a close and it was threshing time. So weeks and even months, 6-8 weeks had gone by, and wheat harvest was even ending, and now it was time for threshing, and she was still under the gainful favor of Boaz. What would cause it? I think the same thing that causes an old barrel on the back of a wagon to go for sale for 50 cents. It's the magnificent providence of God. It's his hand in upholding all things in his creation and causing them to work together for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. It's God who weaves the tapestry of history into this beautiful masterpiece that gives him all the glory. but we don't always see it in our moment. It's usually when we look back on our lives and we see God's kind hand, and it's when we look in the Bible and see a story from our own spiritual ancestry that shows us that God is working providentially through every kind of circumstance, through both good and evil, to accomplish all his good purposes and to further his plan of salvation. This is the story of Ruth chapter 3. It's a story that the bulk of it takes place over the course of a night of complete darkness. And the story is set, like most of these chapters, and is set up with three scenes, and we'll follow those three scenes to unpack this story and to understand a little bit more about God's providence and about his salvation and about what happens when people honor him in their conduct. So look at Ruth chapter 3. The first scene is verses 1 through 6. 1 through 6. This takes place before evening falls completely. This is in the late afternoon or the early evening. It's before the cover of darkness. It's verses 1 through 6, and we'll call this a bold plan. This is a bold plan. I showed you in verse 23 that the harvest was ending. Ruth would have been in the fields each day for many weeks now, and the time comes where Naomi, her mother-in-law, speaks to her for her to gain an opportunity. And look at the words she says in chapter 3, verse 1. "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you?" This is an important word. It's a choice word. She uses the word manoah in Hebrew. It's a word that means peace, rest, security. It's a Sabbath kind of word, a word that means safety and rest, and that's what she seeks for her daughter. She understands that the barley that they've received will sustain them for a season and maybe even into the next because of the appropriation of all the extravagance that Boaz had given to Ruth. She got far more than she would have ever imagined as a result of this arrangement. But Naomi knew in her wisdom that it wasn't enough to sustain two widows in perpetuity. The only way for two ladies, one quite old and one younger, to be cared for was to be under the covering or the protection of a husband, to be part of a family in this ancient world. This was the reality they faced, and Naomi understood that it was needful that she set Ruth up and herself up with something more permanent, something more lasting, something more secure. And so she says, "Should I not seek security for you?" And because of her surprise at God's providential arrangement, even her praise of God's kindness when she finds out how he has dealt favorably with them. She said in chapter 2, verse 20, Naomi said to Ruth, "May he," speaking of Boaz, "be blessed of Yahweh, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." This woman who in chapter 1, verse 19 and 20, talked about how bitter she was and how she came back from the land of Moab back to Bethlehem with emptiness. She went out full. She came back empty and changed her name to Bitter and testified that God had testified against her. Now speaks so differently of the kindness, the Hebrew word chesed, of her experience of God's amazing loyalty as he pours this out on to her and Ruth. And so she sees an opportunity here in these opening verses, and it really is a daring opportunity, a bold opportunity, an opportunity that is risky, and she presents it to Ruth in verse 2. "Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight." the winnowing of barley, if you're terribly interested in ancient agriculture. Well, we've already learned a little bit about it from the book of Judges, right? Gideon was winnowing wheat in a wine press. It was a non-ideal circumstance because a wine press is an outdoor basin, a skate bowl, if you were, will, and you will, for the smushing of grapes with the feet and to make the grape paste. And the, como se dice, threshing floor would not have been a bowl, ideally. It would have been a hilltop, a plain, a place where you could beat this grain, and the winds of the day would take away the outer husk of that and send it away and provide you with a product that was useful and refined, and that was what a threshing floor was. If you're wondering, the threshing floor would have also served as a place of storage before this grain was packaged either into large sacks or brought to a place of more permanent storage or to a place of sale. It would have been kept in its raw form at that threshing floor. And the threshing floor would have been a place that needed to be guarded. And because of thieves in these days, because of impropriety, some have said, why would the owner of the field do this rather than a servant? It was said that the threshing floor was a place of immorality at times. And perhaps the Talmud says that the reason Boaz, the owner, was taking care of this himself was he wanted to make sure that nothing inappropriate happened in this place and that his crop was safe. I don't know if that's even necessary, but I know what the text tells us, that Boaz was there. So if the owner wants to spend the night in the field watching over his grain, that is the prerogative of being the owner. And so he chooses to do so and watches over his own grain. For some reason, either his custom or a schedule that Naomi had become aware of, she knows that tonight is the night that he will be at that threshing floor. Do not picture a grain silo with electricity and tractors. Picture the ancient world, hand tools, no electricity, as dark can be at night. And so she tells Ruth to prepare herself in a particular way. Verse 3, wash yourself therefore, it's the word for take a bath, and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes. That's not there in Hebrew. It's more a word that speaks of a covering, an outer garment. She would not have had a large wardrobe, being a completely impoverished person. So it wasn't like she was putting on, you know, something with a lot of sequins here. That's the wrong look, if that's what you have in your head. She doesn't have heels. She can't afford heels. She's simply putting on a large cloak, a word that becomes prominent in this story and important in this story, a covering or a cloak. Some have said it's because she's trying to, ninja-like, hide herself, but most likely it's because she is going to spend the night outside and she needs to have adequate warmth to endure that evening breeze. And so she cleans herself up, and some have seen in this proposal, and I don't know if I've ever found a chapter in the Bible that has more divergent interpretations than Ruth chapter 3. Scholars take so many different motives of the characters and so many different words that are analyzed. I mean, scholars have spent innumerable pages trying to describe the different innuendo in this text and the different words that could have dual meanings and that are loaded with sexuality. And some of these commentators are obviously stretching. Others are trying to impute motives on each of the characters that the text does not. And so the reason I speak in the subjunctive a little bit on this particular Sunday is the things that are unsure about this text, and I'll show you that some of the large things about this text do have a layer of uncertainty here, are not what's central to this text. And so know that I'm not a wimpy preacher and I'm not willing to decide what is what. I'm just putting it out here like Fox News, fair and balanced. I report, you decide. And I am going to come down strong and hard and bold and mighty like a baby lion about what really matters in this text, and I'll get there eventually, but let's keep doing our work up here. So that's all about a cloak there. So she puts on a big cloak, and she goes down to the threshing floor, much as can be said about the word down. Bethlehem's up, fields are down, there, we're done. So she goes to the place where the grain was stored, and this is the plan that's being hatched for her. Make sure he has a full belly, that he's comfy and happy. There's nothing about him getting drunk here. That's not how you should read this. Verse 4 says, it shall be when he lies down that you shall note or observe the place where he lays down, and you should go and uncover his feet and lie down, and then he will tell you what you shall do. And she said to her, all that you say I will do. It's so important that you've noticed this bold plan that Naomi's laid out here. The plan is not a complete plan. It is simply to uncover feet and then see what he does. This is risky, to say the least. For a single Moabitess, without any covering of protection, without a husband, without a clan, without a family that she genuinely belongs to, she was exposed to great danger here. Anything could have happened this night. Again, this is the time of the book of Judges. We ended our study of the book of Judges with an atrocious scene of rape and horrific crime. So with that environment, this is a dangerous plan, a risky plan. Not only do we not know how other characters could respond in this moment as she travels out to the fields, but we have no idea, Naomi has no idea, Ruth has no idea how Boaz will respond. He may be highly offended by this offer. If you wake me up like this at night, I'm going to bring it. A sword, you're dead, and it's over. Come to my house tonight, you uncover my feet, Philistines are upon me, it's over. You don't have a chance. Don't do this to me. So they don't know how this is going to go, obviously. It's under the complete cover of darkness, but this is the plan she hatches. Some have seen ill motives with Naomi, that she's doing something inappropriate here, and others have flattened this text by simplifying it, by saying this is just simply a Levirate marriage. A Levirate marriage, according to Deuteronomy, when we study that in chapter 25, is a very particular case. It's the case when a brother, according to Deuteronomy 25, live together. They are in a partnership. Their families are joined together in commerce, in agriculture is the idea. And when one of those brothers dies, the word levir, which comes from the Latin word for brother-in-law, has an obligation under Mosaic law to marry that widow to perpetuate her existence, so that his brother, now parted, has an heir, so that the land the brother held onto in part would become all part of this family, and that everyone would be preserved. It was how God intended in an ancient world, in a time of tragedy and loss, to preserve the helpless people in the situation. That's a Levirate marriage. You can find it in your notes in a study Bible. It's not what's happening here. Does it have something in common with what's happening here? Maybe. But these aren't brothers. This is a situation that Deuteronomy 25 does not take into account. There isn't one dead brother. There's two dead brothers. Their wives are foreign women. The problem with marrying Moabitesses, we've already talked about. Your children will be barred from worship. Usually. And when you look at this situation, you recognize that there's something going on here that we do not have biblical data to explain to us. There was no provision in the Mosaic law, as we have it in our Bibles, that describes a situation like this one. It's too many details. So much so that it reminds me of when the Pharisees came to Jesus with a similar outrageous situation. Jesus, what does the law say when a brother dies and he marries her, and then the other brother dies and then he marries her, and another brother dies and he marries her? And stump that, Jesus. Remember that scene? And Jesus says, and they say, who will be her wife in the kingdom? And Jesus obviously isn't taken by their trap. It's such a ridiculous question. Well, this is similarly way outside of the realm of what Levirate marriage was. This was brothers who lived together. There are no brothers here. We need someone to marry Naomi if we're going to follow Deuteronomy. But Naomi is not marriageable, so Ruth is a stand-in for Naomi. And now we need a stand-in for the two dead brothers, and that's a distant kinsman. And so there's cultural things happening here in the book of Ruth that do not have an explanation in the rest of the Mosaic law, and I'm cool with that if you are, because there are no other options. This isn't like a neatly wrapped up, here's exactly what's supposed to happen. You see, the Bible says that when someone is a landowner and single, he lays down and you uncover the feet. It's not in the Bible, okay? The only foot thing is in the Levirate marriage, where if a guy refuses to do his duty to his brother's wife, she's supposed to take off his sandal and smack him with it. It's a great scene. That's not what's happening here. This is not the same thing. Is it related? Yeah, in some ways, but this isn't even called a Levirate marriage by the characters here. Instead, a different word is used, which we'll see in a little bit. It's the word ga'ol. It means redemption. And in the book of Leviticus, it only includes the land. It never talks about marriage. So these people are in a situation that either the culture has said, well, you know, this is obvious that this is how it should work, or this is where the rights are. And when we get to chapter 4 and the city gates, we can muse endlessly about what the customs may have been, because the author knew, the audience knew, we do not know. But what we do know is that this is a risky plan that Naomi sets out. Whether her motives were good or mixed, we don't know. But we do know what happens when they seek to put this plan into action. And so let's look at verses 6 through 15, 6 through 13. It's the middle scene. It's the longest scene. And let's call it a midnight rendezvous. If you can't spell rendezvous, put encounter in your notes, a midnight encounter. And this is where the glory of this story really is. Look at how she institutes her mother-in-law's instructions. Verse 6, so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. And it happened in the middle of the night, and that the man was startled. That middle of the night is the word for midnight. The man was startled at midnight and bent forward, and behold, real 2015. Behold, a woman was lying at his feet, and NIV. And he said, who are you? Come back to me. Verse 9. And he said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your maid. So far, everything's gone according to plan. This is where stuff gets weird. If you take a Bible as literature class, they'll tell you this is where things got, you know, nasty. They say feet is a euphemism for, well, not feet. And in the Hebrew Bible, that is sometimes true. In this case, I believe feet means feet. It's the Hebrew word for feet. And I think she uncovers his feet. Whether she uncovers to his knees, I don't think it matters. but she does according to the instruction she was given. Just because there's euphemistic language here doesn't necessarily mean that there's a euphemism. I'll give you an example of that. This is, I guess, for the seminary dorks, but we'll do this for a second. If I were to say a euphemism for death, I kicked the bucket, right? That's a euphemism for passing away. A person kicked the bucket. There's, for some reason, buckets are associated with life and death, right? If you have things you want to accomplish before you die, you put them on what kind of a list? A bucket list. So if you were at my house and we were taking care of the chickens and I said, will you hand me that bucket? Would you kill me on the spot? Would you think, well, bucket's a euphemism for death, so I'm going to hit him with a shovel instead of handing the bucket. Sometimes bucket means bucket and sometimes feet means feet. And I think that's what's happening here, just so you know. I'm not the only one. One author says this, Michael Goulier wittily suggests, what happened at the threshing floor was all highly symbolic and not at all immoral. Quote, the idea is taken to be sheerly symbolic. No hanky-panky is implied, and the whole atmosphere is pure as the driven snow. I mean, I can't not take the opportunity to quote a commentator who uses the words hanky-panky. So there you go. This is a pure scene, and I'll show you why in a second. She asks more than her mother-in-law told her to ask. Her mother-in-law's instruction said, uncover his feet. She did that. He wakes up startled, probably because cold air on the feet at night makes you wake up startled, or sometimes you just have the sense that there's someone staring at you. You ever had a creepy roommate? You know what I'm talking about. So you pop up, Boaz pops up and sees some shadowy form there and asks, who are you? The same question actually in Hebrew that Naomi asks her very interestingly when she returns home, who are you? She wonders if her status has changed. He has no idea who she is, and he says, who are you? And she answered, I'm Ruth, your maidservant, and this is all Ruth. This is all without instruction, without a plan that we've heard about. This is ad-libbing, this is impromptu, and it's profound. She says, so spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. Wow. There's nothing illicit there. You could look at Ezekiel 36 and see, or Ezekiel 16 and see that that covering of a cloak, the same concept that she put on, his cloak to cover her was an idiomatic expression for marriage, Ezekiel 16, 8. And she asks him to marry her. That's the only way this can be taken. The idea isn't that she's cold and needs a blanket. Remember, she brought her own. It is an expression of purity, of excellence, and she says, spread your covering over your maid, for you're a close relative. Calling on the cultural custom for the redemption of the land that Mahlon, her deceased husband, had ownership of, she's asking Boaz to marry her, and he understands exactly what she's asking. And he responds with kindness. He says, may you be blessed of Yahweh. I mean, how could you read hanky-panky into this scene when he responds that way? May you be blessed of Yahweh, my daughter. You've shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. I just love this exchange. Her request is that, go back to chapter 2, when Boaz offers this blessing over her because he heard of her reputation, of her clinging on to Naomi, of her becoming a worshiping Jew of Yahweh, of converting from, you know, whatever pagan religion she was in. Look at chapter 2, verse 12. Boaz says, "May Yahweh reward your work." He speaks this prayer, this blessing over Ruth. This was way back in that first encounter. "May Yahweh reward your work and your wages be full from Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." His prayer was that God would provide her security, provide her rest, provide her refuge and reward and care for her and protect her. Her request to Boaz is that he would answer his own prayer. This is a very profound moment, a moment full of faith, a moment marked by her position of submission at his feet, a moment that has intersections in cultural mores that we don't know about, but a moment that this woman, new to faith in Yahweh, asks him to answer his own prayer. "Cover me, protect me, marry me, give me this sense of security that you prayed that God would provide." Weeks have gone by, he's not answered his own prayer, but in this moment, it's put upon him in this midnight encounter. And he says, "My daughter, don't fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you're a woman of excellence." There's just too much here, extolling her excellence, extolling his virtue, for this to be anything else than an encounter completely marked by purity. And that's why they will not know each other in a sexual way until they're actually covenanted together in marriage after he makes all the necessary provisions in chapter 4. It would be appropriate at this moment for me to just pause and say something to an oversexed culture about the nature of marriage that I think is presented here and is transcendent to Christian marriage today. Marriage in Ruth's conception, as she's learned from a group of Israelites in the days of Judges, even in these difficult times, Ruth understood something so intrinsically important about marriage that I want to highlight it for you right now. So if you're married, this is helpful in describing and understanding Christian marriage. If you're unmarried, this is equally helpful in you thinking about what really matters in marriage, because the culture tells you there's a list of things that matter, and they would say that lust is first, right? That's why marriage is changing in our culture today, because it's about desire. Whatever a person desires, that should be the basis for the union. That is not what's ultimate, primary, or foundational about biblical marriage, and God created marriage. In this text, she asks for a covering, and he prayed for a covering, and Naomi asked for security. And in marriage, the way God intended it to be between a man and a woman, there is, as part and parcel of it, not just in an ancient and dangerous world, but in every age where marriage exists, there ought to be a sense of security. Marriage has in it a sense of security. And this idiomatic expression about a cloak has implications for Christian marriage. She says, the word wing here in Hebrew, "Cover me with the wing or the corner of your cloak." It's the same word that he said, "May God give you refuge under his wings." She's asking Boaz to answer his prayer, and it's something that's still true in Christian marriage, Ephesians 5, verse 25 through 29. "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." In verse 29, husbands are admonished to nourish and cherish their wives. It's the same kind of terminology we see in Ruth chapter 3. It's protective terminology. How does Christ lead and care for his church? Well, ultimately, as the head of the church, he's over her. He gives her guidance, and he gives her leadership, and he gives her care and nourishment and protection and love. Likewise, Christian husbands are to serve their wives in that same way. As Christ nourishes and cherishes his church, a husband is to nourish and care, protective words for his wife. A woman ought to expect protection and shelter from her husband. And maybe this sounds antiquated to you, but to Boaz, it was a relief to hear that, because he says, you know, you could have gone after any Beamer driving, you know, convertible driving single person in the town. He doesn't say that exactly, but he says, verse 10, you have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. I mean, he's older than her. We don't know how much older. He's considerably older than Ruth. And though a Moabitess, she was marriageable, and he knew that. She could have gone after a good-looking guy with no money, married for love. She could have gone after a not as good-looking guy with lots of money, married for love of money. And she chose not to do that. Instead, she seeks security within the bounds of purity and within the bounds of fidelity and covenant faithfulness. She sees a man who is honorable. She is a woman who is honorable. These are the prerequisites of any marriage that honors God. If you want to be marriageable, be honorable. If you want to be in that ultimate romantic marriage that you've thought about and obsessed about, I wish you would obsess instead about honor, about obedience, about godliness. Because what marks this story is that these people both exist, Ruth and Boaz, with reputations intact. And if you have come from a non-Christian background, or if you have sinned sexually, it is not too late to abandon that worldly approach to human sexuality, to marriage, that looks just like the huge guy at Hometown Buffet, that approaches marriage like it's something to satisfy your appetites, that it's just a glandular experience, and to take on something so much higher and something so much deeper and something so much more profound that it rings into eternity because it looks like Christ's relationship with his church, which is ultimately not about selfish satisfaction and getting what you want and getting off. That's not what marriage is about. Marriage is about mutual care. It's about protection. It's about security, and it looks like the gospel that Jesus died for the church. That's what marriage should look like, not like the gross, granular, visceral kind of experience in this pornified culture that thinks that men and women or men and women and who knows what else is to come just want each other because they want each other. That is not what's happening in Ruth chapter 3. What's happening in Ruth chapter 3 is poetic and beautiful and pure as driven snow, because it's built around being a woman of excellence and a man of good reputation and honoring God, even in this very precarious, very dramatic situation. This could have gone very differently, but it didn't. And the encounter then is explained by Boaz that she should sleep here. It's safe for her to do that. Lay back down. He actually uses a word there, because to lay down is a euphemism for sex. He doesn't use that phrase. He says harbor here, a weird word to choose in this passage. I mean, I was studying this week and keep encountering all these very sexually charged terms. and the commentators, many of them using that for bad and not for good. I think the reason they're there is to heighten the drama of the scene, to heighten the danger of it. There was not an easy avenue for a foreign Moabitess woman working in the field to talk to this man in private. That wasn't appropriate. The reason it happened in chapter 2 is because there was witnesses there. There was a crowd around. It was part of the work day. This is a very opportune moment, arranged providentially by crafty Naomi, and it is a moment where both Ruth and Boaz could have done something very different here, or he could have responded very differently here, but instead he offers her harbor and says, lay here, you're not mine, because someone else has a right to you, and first thing in the morning, I'm going to find out how this goes. You know what I love about this story? Well, let's look at the third scene and wrap it up. And then I'll tell you what I love about this story. So she lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another, still dark. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. He's trying to protect her reputation. He's not trying to cover up wrongdoing. It would be wildly inappropriate for her to be there, for her to be seen walking out. And so he wants to ensure that it's clear that nothing happened here, so he wants her to go back home so there's no gossip. And he says, but don't leave empty-handed. And I just love this in a literary perspective. Empty is Naomi's, you know, modus operandi. She's empty, she's empty, she's empty. He says, don't leave empty. And he measured out 6 measures of barley. If these are ephods, she's as strong as a donkey. So I don't think they're ephods. If they're the smaller Hebraic measurement, it's 88 pounds. Girl still got guns. If it's the smaller Hebrew measurement, it's kind of like 6 scoops. It's not that impressive. So I think it's 88 pounds up on the head, ancient Near Eastern style, guns. So just a side comment. So he gives her these 6 measures of barley. She goes into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, here's that final scene. And we'll call this one an interesting proposal. How did it go? Or who are you, my daughter? She says literally. And she told her all that the man had done for her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley gave to me. For he said, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. A word she'd heard Naomi use so many times. And then she said, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he settled it today. They didn't know what happens next. And if you were following the story the way you're supposed to be, you wouldn't know either. And this is the drama of the whole thing. They don't know how it's going to go with the other redeemer. They don't know if Boaz is being genuine here, if the offer of protection and shelter is legitimate, but they're going to find out. And what I love about this story is it's a tale of obvious sovereignty and providence in God's movement. But you also see tremendous human responsibility. He's doing work here. Boaz is going to try to make this happen, and he does it in a pretty cool way in chapter 4. Ruth, in obedience to Naomi, goes after her somewhat harebrained plan. No one in the story disbelieves the sovereignty of God. They've seen God's hand since the beginning in the famine. Everyone in the story is moving forward in human responsibility and action. Really, it's a beautiful scene, isn't it? Ruth chapter 3, a scene of providence and responsibility, a scene of planning and even scheming, but of God ruling, of people acting according to divine wisdom and faithfulness. And ultimately, I just walk away from it going, what a reminder of what marriage is really about. Dan Block said, Boaz could have treated her as Moabite trash, scavenging the garbage cans of Israel, and then corrupting the people with her whorish behavior. But with true chesed, loving kindness of his own, he sees her as a woman equal in status and character to himself. Robertson McQuillan wrote a book called Promise Kept. And he was a scholar and an author. And in the prime of his educational career, became the president of a well-respected Christian university. But after only a short time there, he resigned from his career in order to care for his wife, Muriel, who had increasingly displayed signs of Alzheimer's. He knew that when he was around her, she was content and happy. But when he was gone at work, she became angry and hostile and even more confused than normal. And so he made this decision against, I'm sure, much counsel to put her in a facility so he could continue his important work in Christian ministry. But he didn't even think about it. He resigned. And he explained it this way in his book. The decision was made in a way 42 years ago when I promised to care for Muriel in sickness and in health till death do us part. So as a man of my word, integrity has something to do with it. It's even fairness. She cared for me fully and sacrificially all these years. And if I cared for her the next 40 years, I would not be out of her debt. Duty, however, he said, can be grim and stoic. But there's more. I love Muriel. She's a delight to me. Her childlike dependence and confidence in me, her warm love, the occasional flashes of wit that I used to relish so, her happy spirit and tough resilience in the face of her continually distressing frustration. I don't have to care for her. I get to. And it's a high honor to care for so wonderful a person. That reminds me of the heart of Boaz, who's presented in this text, not as a Levir, but as a Goal, a redeemer. Someone who meets someone in their distress, a near relative, and pays a price to rescue them and secure their future. Chapter 4 will show us that there is an even bigger picture of this redeemer, this Goal, this one who is a near relative who rescues those he's related to in their deepest distress and permanently guarantees their fortune. Father, thank you for this picture that you've presented before us of marriage, of providence, of selflessness, and even of the picture of the work of Jesus we're beginning to see here. Challenge our radically wrong conceptions of love. Help us to be focused on the needs of others and to take practical steps to meet those needs. God, thank you that your love is not worldly, but it finds its fulfillment in meeting the needs of others. That you, God, truly are a redeeming God, so much so that you sent your Son, in whose name we pray. Amen.